welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are glad that you are with us and hope you had a great weekend. Of course, today is the first day of June, and we begin Main Street today with a conversation that looks beyond the headlines and into the ideas that shape how we think about the world. It's our monthly Philosophical Currents conversation with University of North Dakota philosophy professor Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. For more than a century, students at Princeton University took exams without proctors. The system rested on a demanding idea: a university should cultivate not only knowledge, but honor. This spring, Princeton ended that tradition, citing concerns about generative AI and personal devices making cheating easier. Faculty voted to require proctors for all in-person exams beginning July 1st of this year. The honor pledge remains, but trust now comes with supervision. The change raises larger questions for higher education. If AI can summarize, draft, code, and imitate signs of thinking, what should students still be expected to do on their own? And is college mainly about producing the correct answer or about forming judgment, discipline, and intellectual character? And as universities increase monitoring while acknowledging that AI detection tools can be unreliable or unfair, how should they balance integrity, trust, learning, and due process? Today on Main Street, it's Philosophical Currents time, and we're going to explore what AI is changing about the college experience and what should remain human. Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein is a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota, where he directs the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life. He also hosts Why? Philosophical discussions about everyday life, heard on the second Sunday of each month at 5 o'clock Central, right here on Prairie Public. How are you, Jack?
I'm doing well, and I should start off by saying that I am not an artificial intelligence, although that is precisely what an artificial intelligence might say.
Well, I'm wondering whether you're now a spy or you're a sleuth. And when Princeton adds proctors to keep the honor pledge, is that a retreat from trust or a redefinition of trust?
It is a retreat from trust. It is also a retreat from a sort of different standard for what we have traditionally regarded as necessary for the elite classes, as opposed to the working classes. But before I make sense of that, I want to point out, I think, what a lot of people don't intuitively understand, which is that the fundamental difference between education on the high school level, say, or the middle school level, and college is that in K through 12, the teachers are responsible for motivating the students. The teachers are responsible for making sure the students do a good job. The teachers are responsible for micromanaging things because they're dealing with children and they're dealing with a kind of mandatory education. On the college level, the students are responsible for their own education. The students are the only standard that is set for their own integrity and their own commitment. We, of course, want our students to do well, but it is much easier and much less personal for us to give a student an F or a zero or things like that. So cheating in a high school situation is regarded as a failure of the faculty. Cheating in a college situation is regarded as a failure of the student. And that establishes the central debate here, or at least one of the two central debates, which is how much integrity should we expect our college students to have, and how much should we expect them to respect the process as opposed to just the outcome?
You're an instructor. You probably have realized that students of yours have cheated. Some have maybe been more effective at hiding that from you than others. What goes through your mind when you have students in your classroom that you want to learn, yet they are using artificial means, if you will, to do it?
Well, the first thing is that the big technological shift means that my experience of students cheating is very different. For most of my career, I could tell who was cheating almost immediately, because the cheaters were cheating because they were lazy. And so they cheated lazily. They would cut and paste in an obvious way and forget to change the font. They would be writing in this horrible, unedited, monstrous English. And then there'd be this paragraph of incredible, elegant, sophisticated prose. They would get the questions wrong because they'd find a similar paper with a similar title and use that, and it wasn't the assignment. And so up until AI, knowing that someone cheated was really obvious. And once we had the internet, finding the things that they used to cheat was also pretty easy. Now, cheating sounds much more natural. Cheating sounds much more sophisticated. And rather than include one paragraph or have a tangentially related paper, they're on target, they're focused, and we have to see past that. And that, yes, absolutely requires a kind of sleuthing. There are shortcuts that are famous on the internet, like ChatGPT famously uses the M dash, the longer dash, more than other human beings do. But of course, I use it all the time. It's one of my favorite punctuation marks. And it often cites things that don't exist. So the first time I ever caught a student using AI, I asked them to show me the New York Times article that they cited, and they couldn't because it didn't exist. So it's a much more difficult process because it's a much more obvious process. And the inherent laziness that motivates the cheating is no longer affecting the quality of the cheating. So it completely changes the balance of power, and it completely changes the burden of proof.
Do more students cheat because now AI is unusually tempting? The assignments are there. They're hurdles to learning that you have to get through to learn, but now it's just so easy. So from a student's perspective, their mindset, what do I want to get out of college? Is it now just transactional, a good grade, because I can do it?
I'm glad you asked the second part of the question, because as you presented it, there are two responses. One is empirical, which is that it's very easy to do. It's very quick. You don't have to think very hard in order to get the results. And it's, of course, very, very tempting because it's all over the place, right? Like everything else in our society, we are bombarded by advertisements to use this product because it benefits the companies. And so all we hear now is use AI, it makes better, it's super smart, blah, 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 things that, you know, aren't true. And that makes everyone susceptible to the appeal. But there's a larger philosophical issue and a larger cultural issue, which is the purpose of college has, I don't want to say changed, but the way that we talk about college has shifted a lot in the last 50, 60 years. And especially now, most of our students don't come to college wanting to learn, wanting to cultivate their humanity, wanting to have a better grasp of the world and the nuances of history. They're there for a credential. And they think that the credential, the piece of paper, is what's valuable instead of what's behind the credential. If that's the case, if the only value of a college is the hoop that you have to go through, then you're just gonna use whatever means is necessary to go through it as easily as possible. But if you are there because you understand that you are trying to develop, as you talked about, judgment and wisdom and understanding and make good decisions about your life and strategize and be a good person and understand the process of discovery and see why expertise is so important, then you're much less likely to cheat. And you're also more likely to do the hard things, which sometimes comes with lower grades. And so I want to go back for a second to this idea that I suggested, that the thing about Princeton is that it indicated a different sense of responsibility for the elites. Certainly as far back as the 19th century in the United States, the idea was that colleges and universities were for the ruling classes, that the working classes either went to vocational schools, or when colleges became more widespread, were interested in very practical subjects. But the people who govern us, the people who are the CEO of our businesses, the people who inherit the wealth, they had a kind of, the old-fashioned term is noblesse oblige, which obligation of the nobles. What it means is they have a responsibility as leaders. And there was a sense that because they had a responsibility as leaders, they had to be able to lead in a certain way, and therefore they had to have a certain kind of liberal, holistic, humanistic education. Princeton, Stanford, Harvard, the elite schools have held on to that vision, even though I don't think it's accurate, and have tried very, very hard to be the gatekeepers for the upper classes. And so the honor code at Princeton was a throwback to this idea that you are in Princeton because you are destined to be of the ruling classes, and therefore honor the moral responsibility of leadership and playing your role properly is upon you. Now, Princeton says, we can't enforce that. And we don't have those kinds of expectations anymore. And we're just going to treat our students the way that everybody else treats their students, because there's no fundamental difference. And that is a profound cultural shift in attitude and in talking points. Even if it's pretty far behind the curve in terms of who Princeton was trying to bring into its doors.
Enjoying my conversation with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He's a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota, where he directs the Institute for Philosophy in Public Life. We're talking about AI in college and what it is doing to the value, in a sense, Jack, of what it means to matriculate through college and have that certificate, that degree at the end, and where AI fits into all of this. How do you today, Jack, look at students who are using AI as a tool, just like I use the Dewey Decimal System card catalog as a tool in my library, versus using AI to cheat?
AI is a very narrow tool with very limited capacities. You and I have talked about this in the past, but the first thing to remember is that AI is not intelligence, that AI is mathematics, that right now these large language models, what they are is you ask a question and the computer comes up with a probability for what the next word is. And then after that word, it comes up with another probability for the next most likely word. And it constructs sentences and paragraphs that way. And so it's entirely a mathematical function. It has nothing to do with content or knowledge or facts. Plus,
Or cognitive thinking.
Plus, if it only did that, it would get the same answer every single time, and there would be no variation, and it would be quote unquote useless. So they intentionally inject randomness in it in order to make it seem different, but randomness is falsity, right? So if I ask you what's 2 + 2, a random answer could be Chevrolet, right? That's a random answer. And that's what ChatGPT is doing. So the first problem, and again, as you and I have talked about, is you never know when AI has the right or wrong answer. Second, you never know when it's making stuff up or not. Third, because you're using AI to answer your question, you do not have the expertise or the capacities to decide if AI is right or wrong, right? There are things that you and I do that we have tools, right? You talked about the Dewey Decimal System. It's very easy to figure out if you're interpreting the Dewey Decimal System is wrong, because you go to get that book and it's not there, right? You're looking for a book on weightlifting and you find a book on trout fishing, right? There's an empirical consequence that tells you when it's right or wrong. There's no such thing as that in AI. Now, AI is pretty good at aggregating information, meaning here are 15 essays, summarize them together, although it can often be misleading. AI is quite good at fixing grammar and looking for typos and things like that, because grammar follows very specific rules, not necessarily style, but language requirements that a computer can mimic. AI can be good to help you focus your thoughts. At this point, I tell my students they're not allowed to use AI at all. But I certainly am sympathetic to the student who says, I would like to submit my paper to AI and get recommendations for changes or edits or shortcomings in the argument. I sympathize with that. At the same time, if I were to flip the switch and I said to my students, okay, submit all your papers. I'm not going to grade them. I'm not going to look at them. I'm going to put them in ChatGPT and your grades and comments are going to come from there. They would be horrified and scandalized and justly want their $16,000 a semester back, right? I constantly tell my students, my students get really frustrated with me because I'm very strict and I give them a lot of work. I always say the same thing. And I think this is really relevant. I say, if you go to a burger place and you pay $15 for a burger and they don't bring it to you, you would get furious. And if you go buy a car and you put down $40,000 for a car and they don't give you the car, you would be livid. You would sue them. You would go crazy publicly. Education is the only thing in America that we are happy when we don't get what we pay for. It's the only thing that we are putting hundreds of thousands of dollars down, right? Not just the tuition, but the living expenses and the visits from your family and all those things. We're putting hundreds of thousands of dollars down, and the students are happy when I miss a day, or the students are happy when I take away assignment, or if I were to say everyone gets an A, the student would be really happy. I had a student recently, and I like this student a lot, and I don't want to be too critical, but the student was in my office because they got a B. Actually, I think they got a C. And they were really arguing, and they really wanted an A. And what I said to them in the conversation was, If you were to argue with me in order to receive that A, the A wouldn't mean anything. You would have just won an argument about a result, not made your paper any better. And that same student that semester got an A on the final, went from a C to a B in the next paper, which is usually students in my experience go about a grade higher when they revise and learn, and then got an A on the final paper and got an A in the class. And I bet you $1,000 that getting those A's at the end of the semester was infinitely more gratifying and fulfilling than if they had won the argument with me about converting the C to an A. All of that disappears when you use AI beyond its narrow structures. All of that disappears, and then you go off in the world and you don't know how to do anything. And that's the data that we don't have yet. What we don't have is the sense of what's going to happen when this generation is now operating all of our businesses. When the accountants, when the bank tellers, when the mechanics, when the soldiers, when the TV producers, when they are suddenly thrust into their job and are unable to do it, is the whole thing going to fall apart? I have a lot of pre-law students. Philosophy is the single best major for preparing for law school for a variety of reasons. And I always tell them, you're going to come out of law school having no idea how to be a lawyer. Every lawyer experiences that. But what law school teaches you how to do is how to learn to be a lawyer, how to find the answers, how to look through the law journals, how to read a case, so that the first 5 years of your career, you have the capacities to learn to be the lawyer, even though you don't know day one what's going on. If our law students start off being lawyers having used AI throughout their law school, they're going to go to the office the first day, they're going to stare at the books, and all they're going to know how to do is look at AI to quote unquote win the case. And first of all, we've seen the news a bunch of times, right, that that has not happened, that the judges were furious and some people are getting disbarred. But also, imagine you are defending someone and you use AI, and the prosecution is prosecuting someone and they're using AI, and the judge and the jury are evaluating all this and they're using AI. There's no human judgment. There's no right or wrong. There's no justice or injustice. There's no empathy. There's no hypotheticals. All of that disappears because we spend a huge amount of time talking about the word intelligence in this context, but we don't spend any time talking about the artificial in the name, artificial intelligence. And when you are artificial, you're not natural, you're not human, and you're not experiencing the world like a human being. Even virtual reality allows us to experience the world as a human being. Artificial intelligence has none of that.
We'll be back with more of our discussion in this segment of Philosophical Currents with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein right after this news. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, pleased to be joined by my friend, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He's a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota, and we discuss monthly Philosophical Currents. Today, we're talking about AI at university and how it's changed a lot of things. Jack, there are people, I think, who might feel that they are getting left behind if they don't use AI because their fellow students are and are seeming smarter. Is that a kind of a catch-22 issue that students are going to have to deal with?
I understand the sense of being left behind, both in terms of seeing your classmates, you know, get all A's, although I don't think that's going to happen, but let's pretend getting all A's and you're struggling and getting B's. And they're getting to go out and party and whatever, and you have to stay in and study. I can understand that. And that's very frustrating. And what I would say to that, but then there's going to be a supplement, is if your friend, you know, I'm in Grand Forks, I'm 79 miles away from you. If I decide, right, if one someone else is coming to visit you and they take their car and drive and see you in an hour, that is nice and there's more efficient way of getting to you. But let's say I bike the 79 miles. Yes, we're going to have to meet at a different schedule. Yes, I might be sweaty when I see you, but I'm going to be physically fit. I'm going to have this sense of both mental and physiological health. The process of getting from here to there, to Fargo, is a meaningful process. And so the first part of what I would say is that the student who feels behind is only behind in an abstract, often meaningless consequence, but got a full experience of being at college and got to learn and be, again, that human being. But there's a second thing that is really, really important, which is we are at a very narrow moment in AI technology. We are at the beginning, which is one of the reasons why it's so unreliable. We are investing billions of dollars, and it may be different in 5 years later, right? It may be different in 5 years. We don't know. Whatever the technology is, it's not going to be what we're seeing now. All of those people who invested in Netflix when it sent DVDs through the mail didn't anticipate Disney Plus. And Netflix stock prices and all of these other companies, up and down, up and down, up and down. I know this because my father, when he was in the 1960s, he read somewhere that Hugh Hefner, the owner and publisher of Playboy magazine, had a movie theater in his house with a lot of movies. And he always wanted that. And he always imagined having a movie theater in his house. So in the 1990s, he started recording and collecting videotapes. And he's got his TV room. He's probably got 300 VHS tapes in his TV room, and they're completely useless, right? The quality of the image is terrible. The machines to use them are very hard to come by and inefficient. And all of the movies that he has are easily accessible at the press of a button. This is what's happening with AI now. So if you go through an education relying on one very narrow, specific tool and only know how to use that, you are not able to make the changes once the technology changes. And this is one of the standard arguments, in fact, for philosophy, which is the average American changes, it's been a long time since I've seen this, but job, like careers, like seven times or something, let's say four times just to be safe. The average American changes not just jobs, but careers a handful of times. I know so many students who studied to be lawyers and started to be journalists, in fact, and became super burnt out their first year and decided they hated it. And they had to go back to school because it's the only thing they knew how to do. If you have a holistic liberal arts education, even as a supplement to something specific like nursing accounting or something, sure. If you have to change the circumstances of your life, you have developed the ability to learn something new. It isn't just knowing the subject. It's the ability to learn a new subject. And that's the idea behind a liberal arts education. And that's why there are essential studies or general education requirements. And that's why students just don't come in and on day one, let's say, go pre-med and only take medical stuff and then come out a doctor 5-6 years later. Because you need psychology to understand the patients. You need
sociology.
You need political judgments. We're still citizens in a democracy, right? All that sort of stuff. So the student who feels that they're being left behind because they're not solely relying on AI or not really mastering quote unquote AI, I say to them, wait 5 years. And it's going to be something completely different.
Jack, we're being sold, I think, that AI is a method to lessen educational inequality, allowing greater access, allowing more efficient education to take place. Do you buy any of that?
No, because the words are wrong. AI is a technology that allows more and faster throughput into a university. And what I mean by that is AI is a technology that allows a university to charge more people with less expense so that the number of students who come in and who leave quickly increase to expand the profit margin. And in public universities, there's no profit. So the amount of money that administrators get to spend on their toys.
So you have to pay the bills and all that stuff. Sure.
Yeah. Right. And so AI is not giving access for education. AI is giving access to institutions. The purpose of institution is to educate, and the education is the ability to learn and know more at the end, right? So the argument AI is giving better and efficient education to students, all you have to ask is, you know, this is very easy to measure. Day one, give the students a barrage of tests. Day X, whatever the end day is, give them the same tests, right? We've been doing this assessment for decades. Compare. And a student who uses AI throughout their education is not, and this is what's really interesting about the studies, is not just going to do the same in those exams. They're going to do worse because they will have spent the 4 years not practicing thinking. And not, there was a series of reports that came up, I don't know, 6-8 months ago, that basically said that AI was not helping critical thinking, but it was hindering critical thinking. And I'm not sure this is the right word, but that people who use AI are becoming stupider, right? And so all of a sudden, you now have an institution which brings in more people, gets them through faster, charges more because they have the highest technology, and their students are coming out dumber and less able than when they came in. So as usual, we have to follow the money. As usual, we have to follow the power structures. And that goes back again to that thing I said initially about Princeton and the elite. Not to sound like one of those people, but nobody gives up power voluntarily. And the elite are doing everything they can, as we see in front of our eyes and behind the scenes, to consolidate their power and to remove access to that power to vast swaths of the population that actually thought they were safe. And they are the people who are celebrating AI. If the elite people who have all of the power want us to do something, chances are it's going to benefit them, not us. Now, let me say that in a less, you know, I don't know, Marxist way. Let me say that in a less conspiratorial way. There are three or four groups of people who are making money off of AI. There's the creators of ChatGPT, right? The big companies,
OpenAI,
right? OpenAI, right? And,
sure,
and the
Google and Microsoft, right, yeah. Right.
So there's the creators of AI. Then there's the people who make all the equipment and the chips and the fans and the technology. And we're seeing an incredible increase in cost in computer memory, which is causing a great deal of problems. Interestingly, it caused problems in the video game market before it caused problems in the home computer market, but it's doing that. And then there's the people who are benefiting from the stocks because they know when the stocks go up and when the stocks go down. So the AI creators help support the tech creators. The tech creators help support the stock people, and the stock people help ramp up the stocks of the AI people. At no point in that little cycle is any of that helping you, me, our neighbors, our workers. All you have to do, right? AI, let's say the last 2 or 3 years. Has your salary gone up in the last 2 or 3 years? Do you have more expendable income than you have in the last 2 or 3 years? Do you feel more secure financially and socially than in the last two or three years. If what they were saying were true about AI, we would improve our lives along with AI, but we don't. And the counterexample of this is medical discovery. As we discover new medicines and new treatments and new technologies, our lives are getting better. As we discover, I don't know, new computer technologies, in many respects, our lives have gotten easier. I mean, you and I are doing this from our respective homes, right? Because of the internet. All you have to do is ask, is your life getting better in a way that is related to the improvement of AI? And all that AI is doing is making your job less secure and making it easier for your bosses to fire you.
I'm going to give you a pen through our computers that were connected through the internet, Jack. I'm going to ask you to write University of North Dakota's institutional AI policy. What should it look like if its aim is not merely to prevent cheating, but preserving or advancing its educational mission?
So the first thing that I would require is a disclaimer at probably for professors' purposes, the beginning of the paper that says, I used AI for this specific task, and then list exactly what the AI would do. And since it's digital and we don't have to save trees and stuff like that, maybe put all the raw data at the back of the assignment. So the very first thing I would insist upon is transparency and a paper trail. The second thing I would do is create a policy in which the default is the justification for AI, as opposed to the default being the opting out of AI. That you can use AI if you have a good reason, and to defend that use in such a way that it is not in opposition to the task at hand, right? So for example, let's say I'm writing a paper on the reaction of North Dakota citizens to changes in Prairie Public. I don't know that I have an objection to using AI and ask, give me a list of all of the relevant studies and provide a one paragraph abstract of all the studies ranked in order of importance. I mean, there are people who need to learn those skills, but whatever. Getting and gathering the raw data so that it's in front of you, I think is a useful time-saving skill. I mean, you know, I use Google Scholar and other such things to search for papers. There's not a huge difference there. But to then say, find common themes, summarize the conclusions, identify the three most important trends, that's bad, because that's where the interpretation and the judgment comes in, and that's the skill that you have to learn. So, full transparency, access to the raw data, and arguing why you should use it as opposed to why you shouldn't use it, those three things would be how I would start the policy.
What is the role of middle schools and high schools that we've talked about earlier in preparing the student to come to your class when it comes to AI, Jack, as we wrap up our conversation?
So, American public education gets a bad rap, right? We constantly criticize what it can and can't do. But there are two things that are really important in response to that. The first is, when you look at all the studies, what people say is, yes, the American education system is bad, but their teachers are great, right? The people who teach their students are great. So the criticisms of the American education system are abstract and largely inaccurate. The second thing is that American education system in the last 100 years has done something that no education system throughout history has ever done before, which is educate a mass population of radical differences in background, language, economic, region and experience and religion, right? The dreaded diversity word, right? The D word. American education system has been able to educate everybody in a flawed but very widespread and largely useful institution. However, the middle schools, however, K through 12 uses AI, what it shouldn't do is reduce all of the students to identical numbers in the classroom. It can't say that Sally and Jim and Pedro and Muhammad and Chang and Shlomo and whomever, that they are all exactly the same, that they all have the same experiences, right? You have to know that. And I'm going to end with a story that I actually just told my daughter, because it's a very funny story, and it illustrates it a tad bit risque, but not. I grew up, as we've talked about, in a very, very bad neighborhood in New York City during a very, very bad time in New York City. And I went to Vienna, Austria when I was 25 years old, 24. And my first night, I'm walking down the street and I keep seeing clumps of young men, very well dressed, hanging out in the corner, not talking to each other, staring into space. And after a while, because of my experience, I thought to myself, my God, Vienna has a lot of male prostitutes. And it turned out they were all waiting for the trolley, that they were at bus stops, and that it was early, you know, right in the evening time when the young men were going out for the evening and their dates and stuff like that. It's a ridiculous story because it you know, shows how skewed my horrible childhood was, but it also illustrates how our fundamental experiences are different based on our background. AI can't manage that. So what do the schools have to do? The schools have to do two things. They have to make sure that AI doesn't make all of the students indistinguishable and force them into boxes that are irrelevant to them. And it has to have the students develop the skills to adequately determine when AI is useful for them and when it's not. And if we can do those two things, our college students will be better prepared to meet the challenge of the temptation and the illusion that they're benefiting when they're actually losing out.
We visit with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein monthly on Philosophical Currents. He's a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota, where he directs the Institute for Philosophy in Public Life. And of course, he also hosts right here on Prairie Public, Why? Philosophical discussions about everyday life, heard on the second Sunday of each month at 5 p.m. We've been chatting about how AI is reshaping how colleges define trust, learning, and intellectual responsibility. Jack, as always, it's a pleasure. Now that it's summertime, you'll have an incoming crop of freshmen coming in the fall. Are you going to change the way next semester, the way you talk about AI with your students?
I might very well change the way I talk about AI, and every group has a different context, and the rhetoric and the language and the sort of empathy that I have is going to change. But I will maintain my consistent position, which is it is the student's job to rise to my expectations and not my job to lower to theirs.
Thanks for joining us, Jack.
Thank you. My man is smooth like Barry and his voice got bass. A body like Arnold with a Denzel face. He's smart like a doctor with a real good rep. And when he comes home, he's relaxed with pep.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, stay tuned for All Things Considered with a story about how changing U.S. funding for HIV/AIDS programs is affecting care in Africa. In Mozambique, doctors are battling the disease while also facing major infrastructure challenges, including limited access to electricity and clean water. the fragile state of Mozambique's AIDS treatment system on All Things Considered. That begins at 4 p.m. Central, 3 p.m. Mountain here on Prairie Public, right after Main Street. And tonight on Hidden Brain, what is it that makes humans human? The answer is more complicated than you might think. Explore the surprising ways culture shapes our bodies, our minds, and our behavior. Hidden Brain. That's tonight at 8 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Mountain on Prairie Public. And in baseball, the Minnesota Twins were swept by the Pittsburgh Pirates on Sunday, falling 9-3 at PNC Park in Pittsburgh. Brooks Lee provided the offensive highlight for Minnesota, hitting two home runs and driving in all three Twins runs. The loss was Minnesota's fifth straight. The Twins return home tonight to open a series against the surprising and surging Chicago White Sox. First pitch is scheduled for 6:40 p.m. Central.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 1st. The Ku Klux Klan was founded in 1865 by former Confederates to obstruct the extension of voting rights to Black Americans. Strong Reconstruction Acts were passed by Congress in 1867 and 68. By 1870, the Klan had chapters in almost every Southern state. Members waged a campaign of intimidation against Black citizens and their white supporters. Klan participation gradually declined and was largely inactive by 1890. The film Birth of a Nation was released in 1915. It portrayed the Klan as heroic protector of helpless Southern women against violent former slaves who were determined to seek revenge. The movie sparked a resurgence of the Klan. In addition to Black Americans, the Klan targeted immigrants, Catholics, and Jews. The organization moved beyond the South and spread across the country. In 1918, Presbyterian minister F. Halsey Ambrose arrived in Grand Forks. He incorporated a North Dakota Klan chapter in 1922. Members dressed in traditional Klan robes and hoods for their gatherings. This caused enough concern that the legislature introduced a bill making it illegal for anyone over the age of 15 to wear a mask or head covering that concealed their identity. Ambrose testified against the law. He said that only the Klan was preventing a tide of immigrants from overwhelming American civilization, and that it had to remain secret to grow and do its valuable work. Senator McCoy said that if Klan members were good Americans, they would show their faces. The bill was passed and signed into law over Ambrose's objections. By the mid-1920s, the Klan was in decline. On this date, in 1923, a petition in a Georgia court charged Klan officers with gross mismanagement and requested receivership for the national organization. National support began to fall off for local chapters. In spite of declining national support, the Grand Forks chapter was successful in the 1924 elections and decided to remove Catholics from city government. They fired the fire chief, the city treasurer, and the city electrician. They even fired the city hall janitor. Citizens saw the mass firings as a dangerous overreach. Frustrated, Ambrose left Grand Forks, and the North Dakota chapter of the Klan quietly faded into obscurity. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by the Study ND, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
And that wraps up this Monday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org, or better yet, subscribe to Main Street as one of your favorite podcasts. Tomorrow on the show, WeFest producer Matt Methune joins Prairie Pulse to discuss the history and evolution of one of the nation's longest-running country music festivals. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.